Would like to call this meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. I was just on a hearing of Ways and Means, and the chair there said something about a 30-second delay to get things started. I don't know if that's the case, but it is 11 o'clock, so I would like to get started. A quorum is present. And welcome, everyone. It's good to see all of you. Those of you who have their video on anyway, I can see, and welcome to the committee. So the first thing is that I would just like to remind everyone to please mute your feeds. And we're going to use this same procedure we've used in the past of raising your hand when you want to speak. And then just please leave using the hand raising feature of Zoom, and then just leave it there until the CA or the CLA will put it down. And the staff is going to be letting me know what the order of raising hands is so that we can keep track of it that way. So it's a little bit klutzy, but hopefully we'll manage. So the first order of business is to approve the minutes of March 12th, April 16th, and April 23rd. And these were all sent out. And Representative Kunesh Padin moves the minutes of March 12th, April 16th, and April 23rd. Is there any discussion to the minutes? All right. Seeing none, so everybody now is going to need to unmute your microphones for a moment so that we can vote on approval of these minutes on Representative Kunesh Padin's motion. I got her approval before the meeting to have her make the motion. So all those in favor of the minutes of March 12th, April 16th, and April 23rd, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you very much for that. So, okay, once again, please mute your microphones so we can keep interference to a minimum. And with that, the next thing on the agenda is going to be a brief overview of how we do the financing for PCAs in the state. From the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Members, as you know, today our first bill is going to be a bill that raises wages and makes some other adjustments in our PCA system. And I asked the Department of Human Services to give us a brief overview because, frankly, I think the way we fund this area is very confusing. I know it always confuses me. That's a bit of a problem in itself that it's so confusing, but I thought it would be helpful for us just to frame this up by having a brief explanation of how this works. So it's going to be pretty brief, and I know it's going to be hard to do, but Ms. Merz is here from the Department of Human Services, and if you would just introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Weebly. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Liebling and members of the committee for allowing me to provide an overview of the PCA program. My name is Natasha Merz, and I am the Director of the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services, and certainly welcome the opportunity to highlight this really critical service for Minnesotans, both before COVID and during the COVID pandemic. So this program supports people with disabilities and older adults to provide assistance or get assistance with day-to-day life activities and household tasks to allow them to remain in the community and delay needing to access more intensive services like a nursing home or a home and community-based waiver. So PCA really is the backbone of our long-term care service and support system. It's a flexible community-based service that helps people, like I said, with day-to-day tasks. It's designed to be a service that is flexible and easy to access and promotes and supports people hiring members of their own community to provide that assistance in their homes with the things that they are assessed as needing help with. So I want to just provide a couple examples of what a day-to-day PCA interaction might look like in someone's home. So a personal care assistant may arrive at the person's home in the morning and help them physically get out of bed. So someone that maybe has trouble with mobility or needs help with transferring from bed to chair or bed to other place. They may then provide hands-on assistance at the direction of that person with getting dressed and may remind that person to take their medications or help them with any kind of daily morning grooming that they needed to. They could then move and help that person call or video chat with a friend or have an appointment on the phone if that was necessary, and then help them prepare a meal and potentially plan meals for the next few days, for example. So those are just to give you a sense of the types of really important day-to-day supports that personal care assistants provide for people. I also want to make sure that I highlight that the PCA program, the Personal Care Assistance Program, is one of the most diverse long-term care services and support systems in Minnesota, and it's growing more diverse over time. So as of January 2018, 61% of program participants were people of color or Native American, and approximately 31% of PCA recipients were non-Hispanic and white, compared to an estimated 8% of Minnesotans statewide. So the emergence of COVID-19 and the declaration of peacetime emergency has only increased the need for PCA services. PCA workers are out there on the front lines of Minnesota's response every day, going into people's homes to help them meet their most basic care needs and most physical and needs for physical assistance and support. PCA workers do this despite risk to themselves and risking infection and their families, while receiving one of the lowest wages of direct care workers in Minnesota. And so I think it's really important to point out what a vital role personal care assistants play in people's lives. And as we recognize our front, you know, our healthcare workers as true heroes in the pandemic, I want to make sure that personal care assistants are included in that hero categorization, because the services they provide are vital to keep people able to shelter in place, to keep them safely at home. So I also want to address a little bit how rates are set. The personal care assistance rate is set by state statute and can only be adjusted through legislative appropriations. And so, you know, the department has collaborating with PCA providers, self-advocates, and other stakeholders to really try to make sure that we are putting the PCA program front and center for investment by the legislature, and that we're supportive of your efforts to do that. So I'm grateful to be a part of this hearing this morning, and I will pause there and see if there's any other questions or more specific things that Representative Leland, you'd like me to address about the program.
Okay, well, Ms. Merce, thank you very much. We do have one question from Representative Halverson. I don't want to get into a lot of questions at this point because we are going to have a lot more discussion about this. But Representative Halverson, did you have something right now?
Very briefly, Madam Chair, and thank you for indulging me. And it's a little bit outside the scope of how we set rates and how they're paid. But I did want to see about need and ability for PCAs to get PPE currently, and if that is happening at the state, if that's okay, if I may ask that.
Ms. Merz, do you have information about that? I know that isn't really the topic of the hearing, but I know it is very important to PCAs across the state. Can you answer that?
I can provide a little information. I don't know if I'll have a substantive answer, Madam Chair. Thank you. So personal care assistants are reporting to us, and agencies are definitely reporting that they don't have access to PPE, and they are very concerned about this. We have been working to make sure that we can get home care workers on that priority list for prioritization of receiving PPE. But my understanding is that just the supply limitations generally for that equipment make it a real challenge.
Okay, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to hear more about that. I think we'll have to put a pin in it and talk about it more at another time.
Yeah, I think so. And this, I of course have also heard the concerns about this, and I had the same impression as what Ms. Merce just said, that PPE is still a huge challenge in our state across many sectors. And I think pretty much everybody is struggling with the same thing. So I think we will need to discuss that further. Okay. So Ms. Merce, I wonder, could you just, we have probably a couple of minutes left here. If you could just talk a little bit about the different settings, or there are these different buckets, if you will, in which PCAs work, that there are different ways that they get paid, or different, we've got the traditional and then the sure. other kind. And could you just lay yep. that out for us so we understand how the money flows when we appropriate money to this in this area? Everybody doesn't receive it the same. Could you just explain that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to provide that information. There are two service options within the personal care assistance program. One option is called the choice program, and the other is called traditional. And the difference is, in the traditional model, agencies are the employers, the sole employers of the workers, of the individual PCA workers. In the PCA choice program, there is a joint employment relationship between the agency and the person using the service. So in the choice model, the person using the service really has a lot of employment responsibilities, and the agency helps them fulfill that, but they are responsible, if they choose that option, to recruit, retain, hire, fire, and train their individual PCA workers. Whereas in the traditional program, the agency has more of those employer type responsibilities. So the reason that distinction is important for understanding how wages are paid relates to the existence of a union for through SEIU for people that are choose the choice program. So the workers are subject to a collective bargaining agreement that sets a wage floor for workers in choice. And that same requirement does not exist for traditional PCA agencies. But it's important for it's important to understand that from a DHS perspective, the state sets one rate, and then the agencies, whether they're choice or traditional agencies, determine what wages are paid to the individual. So in the choice program, the individual person using services has more discretion to set wages, but also has to pay that wage floor. And in the traditional program, that's handled by the agency. So DHS itself does not pay wages to personal care assistants. We pay a rate to agencies, and then the agencies pay wages, and depending on whether and that how much those wages must be depends on whether that particular worker is a member of the bargaining unit.
Okay, thank you for that. And just quickly, do you know, is there a breakdown of how many PCAs work under these different arrangements, choice and traditional? Like what percentage?
Madam Chair, I would like to quickly consult with some folks and get back to you. I don't want to give you an inaccurate number. I've got one in my head, but I want to make sure I provide the correct one.
Okay, don't worry about it. We'll get that later, and then we'll send it out to members. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your overview. So we're going to move now to Mr. Berg, who's going to just talk to us for a moment about long-term care spending in our 2019 HHS Omnibus Bill, and just give us sort of a basis so we're all on the same page with that. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, the document you refer to, I actually don't have in front of me. I know Mr. McQuillan sent it out. I am trying to frantically review the fiscal note for the bill in front of us. The upper part of the sheet you're referring to has just the items that we passed last year and the effect of them for the medical assistance subcodes that are for long-term care facilities and long-term care payments. And then the lower part of that sheet shows the total amount of the state spending for each year for those same two subcodes. As I say, I apologize, I don't have that sheet right in front of me.
Okay, yeah, so just so members know, the fiscal note for the, oh, okay, Mr. McQuillan just shared it on the screen, so that's really helpful. But let me just, before we go through that, Mr. Berg is a little bit trying to catch up quickly because we just got a preliminary fiscal note for the bill that we're going to be discussing here shortly for Representative Schultz's bill. So, because we just got that, we're asking Mr. Berg to talk us through that fiscal note. And so he's frantically trying to review that himself. So, maybe if we can just take a look at this for a moment, Mr. McQuillan has it up on the screen, and then we'll give Mr. Berg a few minutes off and he can review
Madam
that fiscal
Chair,
note.
It's okay. I can just go through this. There will be some questions about the fiscal note, but looking at the sheet on your screen, I prepared this last week for the chair. It just shows that in the 2019 omnibus bill, we had six initiatives that affected either the MA long-term care waiver subcode or the long-term care facilities subcode. If you look, we code all medical assistance spending by 105 subcodes, long-term care waivers, long-term care facilities, elderly and disabled, families without children, and adults without children. These two are the subcodes dealing with long-term care. If you notice in the upper section of that for the current biennium 2021, we had six initiatives that affected them, and in total, they spend about $66 million, $65.693 million in net spending. And you'll see those are for the DWRS, primarily the DWRS competitive workforce factor item and the SEIU contract item. There are a couple others that actually saved some money on that, the electronic visit verification and the HCBS simplification waiver item. And then just looking at the bottom, this is the total spending for those subcodes, including changes we made last year, but all the regular programs, the base for those. And you'll see that in total state spending on long-term care waivers and facilities is $5.5 billion, according to the DHS data tables. And that's all there is to that, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bergen. I just really wanted members to see this because with what Ms. Merz just described, is she said, and I have no reason to doubt her, that these are the lowest paid people in our system. And it's not exactly correlated with what you're seeing on the screen here, but we spend a lot of money in this area. And yet we have people who are making extremely low wages for very hard work. So I just wanted members to understand and to see and be reminded that we did appropriate another $35 million for the biennium for the SEIU worker contract. And Mr. Berg, when we do that, that raises wages for across all of the PCAs, right? It's not just in the choice program. Am I correct about that?
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. I mean, there's a collectively bargained contract, but for the other folks that, let me phrase it differently. There was a requirement as part of the language, and maybe Ms. Pennelly can confirm this, that required a percentage of the new money to be passed along as wages.
Right. So I should rephrase just to be clear. It's not that it necessarily raises wages across the board, but it's allocated to agencies across the board. And then when the legislature requires some of it to be passed along as wages in the traditional program, that's how we have some control over that. But again, we don't as Ms. Merce said, DHS is not directly paying those wages. So it's a really complicated system when we raise the rates, how it actually gets through to the people who are doing the work is a little bit complicated. So I just wanted to explain that for people as a basis for this. So Mr. McPullen, if you can go back to the regular screen, great, thank you. Okay, so now we're gonna move, and I know Representative Schultz had her hand up, but I'm gonna give the floor to Representative Schultz. In fact, she's going to move. First of all, we have House File 168 on for hearing today. So Representative Schultz is gonna move House File 168 to bring it before the committee. And then she's gonna move the amendment. And I'll give the floor to you, Representative Schultz, so you can make that motion.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So I make a motion to move the DE2 amendment for House File 168. And then after that, I have a technical amendment on that DE2.
Okay, so the DE2 is, as members may know, the House File 168 is just being used as a vehicle here. So the DE2 amendment is to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. So I think we should vote on the DE2 and then discuss it, and then we could take the technical amendment. So if everyone could unmute, we could vote on adoption of the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like to discuss it. So any discussion to that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. So we have that now in front of us with the DE2 amendment. So Representative Schultz, you have the floor.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members, for hearing this bill. This is a bill that we intended to work on during session. So I asked Representative Lippert to take charge and actually overhaul the rate methodology used for PCAs. As you may remember, last session we looked at the disability waiver system, DWRS, and we overhauled that system and increased wages there by a competitive workforce factor. And our intention was to do that within the PCA world, look at the rates and make sure that we were able to increase wages for PCAs. So there is a huge shortage of PCAs. I think I've heard up to 20,000 that are needed. And we're trying to address that shortage as well as the wages in this DE2 amendment. I'm gonna just have Representative Lippert explain the bill, but I just wanted members to know that similar language is moving through the Senate by Senator Abler, and Representative Lippert has been working with Republicans in the Senate, and he can explain that. But this bill, as you know, Representative Considine was a big supporter of making sure we increase wages for PCAs because they're so underpaid. So this bill increases the rate at 15%. At least 80% of that rate increase needs to go to wages or benefits, and the other 20%, up to 20%, would go to PPE, as Representative Halverson asked about PPE, and supplies to make sure that they have the supplies to do the disinfecting that they need to keep the environment safe and to kill the virus. So I'll turn it over to Representative Lippert, and then I know we have testifiers, and then we can take questions.
All right, thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Lippert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Representative Schultz and members. So we need to make sure that Minnesotans can access the care they need right now, especially people with disabilities and seniors who are depending on one-on-one care in their homes. And as we've heard, COVID-19 has placed additional strain on our PCA workforce. And this bill seeks to help stabilize that workforce and ensure that this care continues. There are college students who worked as PCAs who are now home, who can't do this work. There are PCAs who are getting sick, and more will get sick, leading to more shortages. So we need a response that's recognizing that this caregiving work is critical, that increases pay to incentivize PCAs to keep working in the midst of increased risk, and that will make it easier to recruit new PCAs as well. At the same time, those who are receiving PCA services are concerned about PCAs who are ill and bringing COVID-19 into their homes. So they're reducing the number of PCAs who work with them. So we need to make sure that if PCAs are sick, they can afford to stay home. We also need to raise the number of hours that a PCA can work with a particular client and allow for more flexibility if the PCA in the PCA space to ensure that this care is provided. So as Representative Schultz mentioned, this bill provides a temporary 15% rate increase for PCA providers. It ends in February 2021, or 60 days after the peacetime emergency. It allows the increase to go to wages and benefits, which would allow it to be used towards paid leave. Dollars can also be used to purchase needed PPE or basic cleaning supplies. It permanently raises the monthly hour cap for PCAs from 275 hours to 310 hours, which would allow for a PCA to work with a single client longer. And then it also temporarily allows people to receive PCA compensation for administering care services to their spouse or a child under 18 in their family. So we have family members who are providing this care in this time that may need to be pulling back from work to be able to do that with a shortage of PCA. So we want to make sure that we're recognizing the value of that care and compensating family members for that. So I'll stop there and turn it over to testifiers at this time.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lippert. That is very helpful. And before we go to testifiers, I wonder if Representative Schultz, it's up to you, but we still do need to take care of the A6 technical amendment. Do you want to do that before the testifiers, or do you want to wait?
We can do that now. So I'd like to move the A6 technical amendment to the DE2.
Okay. And so Representative Schultz moves the A6 technical amendment. Is there anything to discuss about what this does, Representative Schultz?
It adds the word benefits to page 6, line 30, after increased wages or benefits would be the new language, or benefits.
Okay. All right. Any discussion to the A6? Okay, hearing none, everyone, if you would unmute your lines, we can, I think, do a voice vote. So all those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. All right, motion prevails. The A6 is adopted. All right, great. So with that, we're going to go to the first testifier, who is Robert Woodlick. Mr. Woodlick, are you here?
Yep. Hi.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead. And if you could just do a couple of minutes, that would be great.
Great. My name is Rob Woodlick. I'm with the Minnesota Communities Consortium for People with Disabilities and Get Up Stand Up to Cure Paralysis. I'm also a person with a spinal cord injury and receive a lot of home care assistance. Thank you, Chair Liebling, and members of the committee, Representative Schultz, for moving this bill. So before this COVID emergency started, I had problems with recruitment for PCA. And now I have more added pressure. One of my caregivers, his wife works at Bethesda, and so we decided that they weren't doing in-home kind of safety precautions. So I lost one of my home caregivers through that. And, you know, I'm very concerned about bringing multiple people into my house that have been in other houses and so on. You know, as a person with a spinal cord injury, my respiratory functions 50% of what it should be. So getting COVID would be very serious to me and potentially life-threatening. So, you know, doing this rate increase is going to help a lot. I think it's the most basic, it's the most obvious basic thing that needs to be done. It needed to be done before this. And it definitely needs to be done now, especially on a temporary basis. Increasing the cap hours per week, hours per month, is the second most effective thing, and using some of that money for PPE is going to be very helpful. If you know the counties or the state can help source PPE to the agencies, and definitely not putting that burden on individual caregivers, that's going to make it a lot more effective and easier for people to get PPE and the places that are needed for home care. I do want to point out, 15% rate increase is really good. I personally don't think it's enough. So an average caregiver PCA makes $11 to $13 an hour. The maximum amount with a 15% rate increase will go up to $14.95, which still doesn't meet the minimum wage requirement in Minneapolis of $15 an hour. So it's something to note. I thank you very much on everything that you guys are doing. And yeah, I think this will definitely help. So thanks.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Next we have Pang Vang. Are you on?
I am. Can you hear me?
All right. Yes, I can. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Pang Vang, and I am a PCA agency owner, and I'm also a board director of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. The Minnesota First Provider Alliance is an association made up of about 200 providers in the state of Minnesota. We have been hearing from our members, and they've been reporting that more and more PCAs are unable to work. Some of them are being told to self-quarantine because they have other jobs and they've been exposed to COVID-19 from their other jobs. We also have clients who are unable to go to day programs. And because they are unable to go to day programs because they're closed right now, they're requiring more hours of care at home. Traditional PCA providers have been trying to find ways to make sure clients continue to receive care and not end up in the hospital. Providers are asking existing caregivers to pick up additional clients and additional work hours. A temporary increased PCA reimbursement rate would allow providers the ability to pay for the overtime in order to pick up more hours, a lift on the cap from 275 hours to 310 would also allow them to pick up a couple additional hours for other clients that need it. This would allow, like I said, PCAs to help fill in for other workers and to take on additional clients. I don't know if this is my testimony, but I don't know if you guys wanted me to answer some of the questions earlier regarding choice and traditional and how they're paid. Because one thing is that as agencies that we have to keep in mind is the floor for the union bargain contract, but also we have to keep the city ordinances minimum wage in mind. So, you know, Minneapolis is $13.25 and then going up to $15, same with St. Paul. That starts this July. So that's something that a lot of our members have been asking about is in meeting the required minimum wage ordinances along with trying to find caregivers right now and all the constraints that we have to work with.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for your testimony. And I forgot to say, too, we're going to hold the questions till the end of the testifiers here. But if members want to get on the list to ask questions of any of these testifiers, please do that. And we'll take a few minutes for questions at the end here. If the testifiers can stay, that would be great. Next on the list is Stacey Zamora. Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So, Chair and members, thank you for the chance to speak in favor of the bill today on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, and the tens of thousands of people who need this bill enacted. My name is Stacey Zamora, and I'm a PCA for my son, Brent. I'm also a registered nurse at United Hospital. I don't need to convince anyone here that the work I do at United is more needed than ever. But Brent's care is my main priority, and yet for his entire life, his care hasn't been considered essential enough to provide his caregivers with living wages and benefits. Our home care programs have been in crisis for years, and it's taken a worldwide crisis for our state to recognize how essential our home care workers really are. Thank you for leading the way to save our programs with this bill. A 15% increase to wages and benefits will give Brent's PCAs and myself the hazard pay that all healthcare workers deserve. If any of us become ill from exposure, this could also allow us to the sick pay, which is necessary to meet financial obligations during a quarantine period. The need for a PCA to quarantine opens essential care needs that must be covered, which results in a PCA exceeding the 275-hour cap. Therefore, I support the increasing the cap to 310 hours. For the safety of Brent, his PCAs, myself, and my patients, we need this rate increase so there can be stable jobs with the tools to keep clients safe. From talks with members, we also know that there are thousands of families across Minnesota who have lost both their income and their PCA care during this crisis. Thank you for recognizing that lifting restrictions on paid spouses and parents will help our families weather this pandemic more easily. Again, thank you for considering this urgent bill and for helping us secure the funding we desperately need. This will help home care clients remain in their homes where they belong. Our hospitals and long-term care facilities are inundated, and Minnesota cannot afford to let our home care system fail.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Zamora. We appreciate it. And then we have David Bolin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bolin. I'm representing Circle of Life. We are a PCA agency primarily serving Native Americans, and we are in strong support of this bill, moving the rates up temporarily 15%. Is going to help our caregivers who are out every day getting people up, helping them go to bed, doing all of their activities of daily living and IADLs, the intermediate activities of daily living, so that our people can stay in their homes and out of hospitals and out of nursing facilities, which are much more expensive for the state. And most people, all of us, would rather stay in our own home rather than having to go to a facility. And congregate living is a little more difficult with COVID-19 across the country. The rates of infection in congregate settings has been pretty high. And so we want to keep our people in their home where they have less risk of being infected. And the changes that this bill makes are really good. The 15% helps us to be able to pay our people, and will pay for some of the help us pay for the PPE that we already have on order, because we are proactively looking for PPE around the world. And then being able to increase the number of hours that a caregiver can work really helps us to be able to fill missing shifts. So if somebody has issues with their kids being home and not having childcare, we need to be able to fill all of those shifts, because serving people comes first. And then also allowing spouses and family members to provide services in this emergency is really key, because at times people don't want anybody other than a family member being in their home. And that's totally understandable when you're at risk for infection. So again, we strongly support this, and we thank Representative Schultz for bringing this bill. That concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bolin. Appreciate that testimony. So we have a couple of member questions here, and then so we have Representative Baker and then Representative Knorr, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Berg to talk us through the fiscal note, because we have only a preliminary fiscal note and we just received it. So I frankly haven't had a chance to read it yet. So, and I wonder if anybody or many of us really have. So Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think part of it is what I think is coming next, but I'll be brief about my statement. And that is really about the fiscal note. Why we are getting it 15 minutes after the meeting started. Again, this is a very fluid situation, I understand, and all of us do. But we need to make sure we kind of look at all the components of the things coming at us from a fiscal standpoint. So I'm looking forward to hearing more from Mr. Berg. But also maybe back to Mr. Wudlick in his comments. I think he had a lot of really good points. I think that I have been a person has been wanting to support a better PCA reimbursement. I sit on a board with West Central Industries, and I'm closely connected to this community of folks that are helping people. I think I just wanted to say that as I support the PCA improvements, it's more of a challenge right now during this unknown fiscal cliff that we may be facing, likely are facing, to be adding new PCA members through family members and such right now. It's a really challenging time, but he hit a chord with me that said a lot of this, though, should be worked towards focusing on PPE for family members. I think that was a really well-stated point that we need to focus on, but I'm just having a hard time maybe trying to see the whole circle of financial obligations that the state is going to be facing. We need to take care of these PCA members. But just did I hear you correctly, Mr. Wudlick, in that the PPA is a real high priority for you? Thank you.
Mr. Wudlick?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, you know, I don't expect my mom to be wearing a mask all the time when we're in her house, but for people that are coming in and out, that's a huge point. And, you know, not putting that burden on individual caregivers or families to have to go on Amazon or eBay and find masks when it's already difficult to get them in time.
All of your caregivers made them.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My question is to do with the increase. So there are two questions that I have. Number one, we know some of the cities are going to be increasing the minimum wage floor. For example, in Minneapolis, that will go up automatically by July. And also, Ms. Vang talked about the increased hours, including Mr. Woodland. So how are we going to accommodate the overtime pay for agencies, whether they're traditional or the choice program, and be able to balance that equation and be able to pay fair wages to the employees? And the other question that I have is, if we're going to be dedicating 80% of that resources to go to the wages, because of the settings that we already have, how can we ensure that the 80% goes to increased wages rather than part of the payment for the benefits and also for the agencies keeping some of that money? So can we get a clarification? Can we order the 80% to be added as a wage increase for the employees?
So I don't know if that question would be better answered by Representative Lippert or Representative Schultz. Do one of you want to, or who exactly that would be directed to? Probably the part about the 80% would be under this bill. So Representative Lippert, is that something you could address? I think you're muted. Sorry.
So I think we recognize, as Mr. Wudlick said, that we're going to be dealing with minimum wage floors in Minneapolis, especially. Part of the larger effort, a PCA reform effort, the bill I was carrying, I'm carrying as well this session, would be dealing with that and restructuring compensation for PCAs in general. As we are dealing with this more emergency situation, we felt like the 15% increase was the easiest, simplest solution for trying to get increased wages and benefits to PCAs.
Representative Schultz?
Yeah, I just want to add to that. So a lot of the agencies are already paying higher wages, especially in the metro area. So the 15%, many of them may get to higher than the $15 minimum wage. It depends on what their starting point is. But we're going to have reporting requirements, and the agencies will get data to make sure that the rate increase is going to wages. So we'll get to look at that and make sure that it's getting pushed out into wages or benefits or for PPE.
Representative Noor?
Madam Chair, I think there are cities whereby there is going to be huge difference of the pay. But for Minneapolis, I think that means it's already going to be increased by July, by the month of July. So I look forward to working with the agencies and the department to get things done.
Yeah, thank you very much. Those are really good, important questions. And I really appreciate that we have members who are really focusing on this, because this is a complicated area, but it's also a super important area. So we have not resolved everything here for sure. So I have Representative Olson and Representative Haley. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to go, I know we're going to talk about the fiscal note in a minute, but maybe wondering if someone from DHS could comment as well. I know within the realm of when we're talking about at-risk populations during COVID-19, that this would be one of the places that we're probably most watching as a state. But speaking to, you know, when we're talking about, heard some consternation from Representative Baker and others, but as we go into talking about a fiscal note, the place where we could probably likely have the most preemptive impact would be looking at an at-risk population that touches people all over the state. I think, what was it, about 105 folks received PCA services. So within the realm of, where do we see, at-risk populations outside of like residential services, I imagine this would be one of the biggest places where we could have the biggest impact right now before we get to even more of a crisis state than we're already in, which we are in a crisis state. And we were before COVID-19, as our testifiers talked about. But, in relation to, again, before we get to the fiscal note, talking about why it would be so important to really hone in and how the department or MDH and DHS are thinking about really targeting at-risk populations with what we do now, I think would be helpful perspective to have.
So Representative Olson, if it would be okay with you, I would like to defer that discussion because I think we're going to have a hearing on that. Probably our next hearing is going to be about that very topic. And I think that Commissioner Malcolm is going to want to come and talk with us about that very thing. So this is more about narrowly on the PCAs and the funding pieces of this. So if it would be okay, I would like to defer that discussion rather than have DHS talk about that right now. And I'm not sure, they're probably not really prepared for that today.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And can I just add one?
Please.
We're not going to do that. I think the point I'm trying to make too is ahead of the fiscal note and how important this bill is right now. And with the investment we make, it's probably one of the most targeted areas we could have an impact around PCAs. And I was really struck by the numbers that the opening testifier really honed in around people of color, spread in greater Minnesota, just the largest impact, and just want people to keep that in mind as we talk about the fiscal note.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to comment and kind of tag along to what Representative Olson said. I certainly appreciate the importance of these services and the urgency around this area. What concerns me is, as a finance committee, our fiscal responsibility and the not knowing where our budget is headed. I just wanted to go on record with that. And I know today, I believe there's a committee hearing in Ways and Means to discuss how we allocate the federal dollars that we are receiving to fight COVID-19. And because, to Representative Olson's point, this is very much a high risk population for impact on this disease, I would like to see this be a priority in that discussion and allocating our federal dollars here rather than taking from the general fund, because we do not, we don't have a clear picture of our general fund resources at this time.
Right. Thank you for that, Representative Haley. Well, we're going to have Mr. Berg discuss the fiscal note. And I just want to remind people that PCA wages are partly paid by the feds. So this is not only a general fund cost. We do get a federal match for this. And I'm sure Mr. Berg can talk about that a little. So let me just first address Representative Baker's question about the fiscal note. We've been trying to get a fiscal note, and we've been trying and trying, and we've had this scheduled. We wanted to have this. The bill is going to move, assuming we can pass it out today. It'll move on the floor to Ways and Means. And we have floor session tomorrow, so the bill can move. So even though this is just a preliminary fiscal note, we're glad to have a fiscal note here. This definitely would not leave Ways and Means without a fiscal note, but given the uncertainty of the situation and sort of the urgency of getting this these funds moving, we thought it would be important to move this anyway, even if, well, at the beginning of this hearing, we did not even think we were going to have a fiscal note at all. So we appreciate that we get some kind of a fiscal estimate, and I will turn to Mr. Berg to discuss exactly what we have. Mr. Berg. Oh, and you are muted, sorry. Yep. There we go.
And members, I think you can hear me now.
Yes.
Yes, I just on the timing of the fiscal note, I'll just note the language just got finalized in the DE2 amendment last Thursday early afternoon, and the fiscal note request went in at that time, and so DHS got their portion of it done over the weekend. I'll just touch on briefly why it's a preliminary fiscal note there. Their portion just got done this morning, and so the LBO has not signed off on that, although I have communicated with the LBO while we're meeting, and they have a couple of things that they want to note on it, but have said to me that they don't think any of the things that they have concerns about change the numbers. However, Minnesota Management and Budget is also on this fiscal note, and they haven't yet submitted their portion. I'm told by the LBO that they anticipate putting their portion in later today, hopefully. That will contain some costs at MMB for the contract negotiation costs for SEIU. But so what we have is the preliminary numbers for what the cost of the benefit will be at DHS. Just from the front page perspective, the top line view of what this costs, you'll see there's a minimal $43,000 in costs in fiscal 2020 and $26.2 million in 2021, so just over $26.2 million in the current biennium, and about $1.2 million a year in ongoing costs, and I'll touch on that now. This bill does a couple of different things. And so one of the things it does is raise the number of hours that are eligible for reimbursement from 275 to 310. That's a permanent change, and that's what creates the tails costs of around $1.2 million a year ongoing. Just to note, the assumption that does not require federal approval. So the assumption in the fiscal note is that it's effective the day following final enactment. So there's an assumption that it would be May 18th, which is the day, the constitutional deadline for the session. That's the assumed date at which the 310 hours starts. And then it's a permanent change, as I say, which creates that tail. The bulk of the items come, of course, from the 15%. And let me just touch on that. That does require federal approval. The effective date of that section is a day following final enactment or upon federal approval. The assumed date in this fiscal note is that they'll have approval by June 15th of this year. And then it is the rate increase is effective until January 31st of 2021 or 60 days after the peacetime emergency ends. So this fiscal note assumes payments from the extra 15% from June 15th of 2020 through August 29th of 2020. that's where those costs of the bulk of that $26.2 million comes in. Now, I will note the fiscal note also notes that it could go longer than that if the peacetime emergency goes longer than the assumption in this bill. It would add costs that are not reflected here in the long-term fiscal consideration section talks about this, that it would be approximately $10 million a month of additional costs if the peacetime emergency extends longer than the assumption that is that it will terminate on June 30th of 2020. So there's some uncertainty in that. Madam Chair, maybe that's kind of the high level at this point.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Berg. And again, I'm sorry that we did not have this earlier. I mean, Mr. Berg explained some of that. And the reality is that things are moving very quickly. The need is great, obviously, from the testimony and from our members who've explained what this is coming to do. And the reality, too, is that we really don't know what our fiscal situation is going to be. And I don't think you addressed this, Mr. Berg, but there is federal financial participation in this. Could you just mention that?
Madam Chair, yes, I forgot that. You were correct in your statement at the beginning that this is a shared program with the federal government. For the most part in our medical assistance program, the federal government pays 50% of the costs and the state pays 50% of the costs. And a very minor aspect in this fiscal note, for administrative costs, there's also the state pays a slightly different share and the feds pay 32% of the system's costs. But for the benefit, the main amount of the $26.2 million that gets paid out, the federal government pays the same amount. This represents 50% of the cost, which is what the state will pay.
So, Mr. Berg, I had understood that there was a higher FFP, a higher federal financial participation right now under the COVID emergency.
Madam Chair, remind me, there is, but I do not believe that is factored in this fiscal note at this point. I will email Mr. McQuillan to get back to you to make sure on that. I'm going to have to check the table on it. There is an increased FFP, and I'm not sure that it is factored into this note or not. I don't see that it is, but let me check on that.
Okay, well, that would be great. Maybe certainly for Ways and Means, it would be great to have that, and that might reduce the state cost, of course, if indeed the match is higher for this.
Right.
And all right, thank you very much. So we have Representative Moran on the list. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question maybe for Mr. Berg, possibly, but I'm just wondering what would be the average dollar increase per PCA workers during a peacetime emergency?
Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, I cannot answer that question. That, again, we don't pay wages directly. That might be better answered by one of the agency owners or.
Yeah, Representative Moran, that's one of the mysteries of this whole area. It's really hard to say in different settings. So I think even if one of the owners could answer, it would be only for their agency. So, I mean, that's a very tough thing. But I'm told that Ms. Bailey from DHS can speak a little bit more to the fiscal note. Ms. Bailey, are you on?
Yes. Hi, Chair, members.
Hi.
I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the Fiscal Policy Director for the department.
To answer your question about the enhanced federal match, we do have an enhanced federal match, and we are only assuming that through the end of June. We're unsure about how long it will go. And so how we factored that into this fiscal note is that any increases or any changes that are paid through the end of June 30th of 2020, that was incorporated. But after that, for the next fiscal year, we assume that it would go back to the normal match of 50%.
Okay, and Ms. Barry,
In reality, it could go longer, you know, if the emergency lasts longer and the federal government sends out additional guidance on that, but that's what we assume.
All right, and Ms. Bailey, while we have you, can you address Representative Moran's question at all about, I think it was average wages increases? If you heard the question, or Representative Moran, do you want to repeat that? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Bailey, the question was, what would be the average dollar increase for PCA workers during a peacetime emergency?
Ms. Bailey?
Representative Chair, I think that question I could probably try to get you an answer to. One challenge with that is that we don't know the wage value for all of the PCAs on the program. We only know it for a portion of them that are on, I believe, the Choice program. But I can get you, you know, an average maybe based on what the rate is.
Madam Chair,
Representative Moran,
could you give me what you know, an estimate of what that increase would be?
Well, Ms. Bailey,
for some you knew maybe what the cost would be, increase would be.
You know what, Representative Moran, maybe the thing to do would be to ask Ms. Bailey if she can write up whatever information she can get, because I think that's going to take some calculating. Mm. Right. And maybe we can get that out to all members if that would be okay.
That would be fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bailey. So, members, we need to get to a vote on this by in about 8 minutes. I have three more members who want to ask questions. Representative Baker asked something before, so I'm going to first go to Representative Bierman, and then I'll go to Baker, and then, I see Representative Grunhagen also has a question. So let's go Bierman, Grunhagen, and Baker, but we need to move through pretty quickly so we can get to a vote. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just hopefully quick questions. I was just wondering about the length of time it might take for federal approval for this increase. And also, when we had begun the hearing, we talked about a set rate by state statute. And I was just looking for some clarification on what that actually says insofar as wages are not the same in the Choice program and the traditional. And if someone wants to get back to me offline, that's fine as well.
Okay. Ms. Bailey, do you want to try to address that?
Chair members, let me take a quick look at the fiscal note. The way we do fiscal notes is we just apply, because this bill applies a 15% on top of the spending that we would do that we already currently incur in the program. That's how we calculated the fiscal note, but I can get the exact rate difference. It would be the current rate with a 15% add-on. Oh, I'm getting a message. For one-to-one, it's about, I don't think that's correct. Sorry, I will get that information for you.
All right, let's take that one offline if that's okay. And members, this is really complicated. For all the time I've been doing this, I find this so confusing. So anyway, we'll try to answer some of these questions offline. All right, Representative Grunhagen.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, thanks, Chair Liebling. And I have relatives that use PCAs, and I know they're underpaid. So it is an area that we definitely need to address. However, you know, we have been spending money quite a bit lately. And according to what I've heard, MMB is projecting a pretty good sized deficit next biennium because of this and the COVID-19. So are we making any type of reduction in some other area to offset the increased cost that we're doing here? You know, I like a lot of the provisions. I like the idea that 60 days after the emergency powers is gone, there's a provision in there. And again, I agree that they need some type of an increase, but I got a hard time voting for it when we're going to have to make tough reductions next biennium, possibly in this area or someplace else. And it'd be better off to address it now rather than later, is my thought.
So I think that's more of a question for me, Representative Grunhagen. Thank you for raising that. My feeling is that we have to take care of urgent priorities. And when we have a budget deficit, if we do, we'll have to deal with that then, and we'll have to decide what our priorities are. But personally, I wouldn't want to cut the wages of some of the lowest paid people doing the hardest work. That would be one of the lowest priorities for me as a cut. So, you know, I think this is really important. I think right now we have to focus on things that actually help us during the pandemic, help keep people safe. And this, for me, is a high priority for that kind of use of our funds while we have them. I've been through budget cutting. It isn't fun, and we'll just have to cross that bridge when we come to it. That's my feeling about it. I have Representative Baker and then Schumacher, if we could move through this quickly, and then we'll get to a vote.
Madam Chair, thanks. Quick question for Mr. Berg. The $26 million that you had brought up before, there's two major components of this. One is the 15% increase. Also, the other one is the increased hours. Can you tell me roughly of the $26 million, is that roughly split about half? If we have to start making some choices, do we do the increase in pay for the same amount of hours or the increase in hours and the pay? Can you tell me roughly how does that add up? How does that break out a little bit? Just high-level rough numbers on that. Thank you.
Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, no, it's very disproportionately the 15%. As I mentioned, the numbers you see in the tails, about $1.2 million a year is the ongoing cost of the hours. And if you give me just a moment, the fiscal 21 estimated state cost for the hours portion of it, going to 310 is $1.1 million. So the vast amount of the $26 million is for the rate, the 15% bump in the rate.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points briefly on this. From my understanding of Ways and Means, this morning, the $1.9 billion that has been put into the fund there would be used for the short-term response programs, and that something like this would be able to be qualified as expenses that could only come out of that. If there's any further guidance on that, I think that would ease our members' hesitation on this quite a bit right now. If we know that there is a pot of money that came from the feds to do this sort of thing, on a temporary basis, I think, and it's not going to be coming out of the general fund for that and adding to the deficit that we have suspecting to have moving forward, I think that would definitely help us out quite a bit. I did appreciate the SEIU testimony today and referring to it as hazard pay. That helped set the frame for me on that one piece there. So if we could get some confirmation on where that would be coming from. The other piece I do have a little hesitation on is the hours, the raising the hours and making that a permanent piece. The testimony we heard today was just why we need it on this temporary basis, but not moving forward with that. And so if we could get some clarification moving on that too, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. So Representative Schultz or Representative Lippert, do you want to respond on the hours piece, Representative Schultz?
So the hours piece, my understanding, it was removed in a prior administration as a way to reduce costs, and it's where I would like to see that restored. And I'm getting so many emails from PCA saying that their client can't find another PCA and they're working 7 days a week, and they're doing it out of the goodness of their own heart and their compassion and care for others. And so I think in this case, we need it more, but we need to make it permanent just to restore something that was removed in a prior administration. And the other piece I just want to mention is this is actually going to save us money, the state, because the alternative is for individuals to go into a nursing home, which is so much more expensive than those individuals staying home. So to represent Gruenhagen's point, you know, we're spending money now, but it's preventing us from spending a lot more when these individuals have to be placed in a nursing home, which is even higher risk to be in that setting. And this is where a lot of the outbreaks are happening. So that's why this is urgent, and others can respond about which pot of money we do. But, you know, I would like to see this rate increase permanent, so go beyond the emergency. And I think that's a conversation we'll have to come back to.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Representative Schultz. I think that's an excellent point. And Representative Schumacher, to your point about the use of federal funds, most of what we have appropriated, those pots of money we've appropriated for COVID, we've explicitly included that this would be replaced by federal money if it becomes available, that would be spent first. And so we are for sure going to be looking at that every step of the way here because, you know, as we know, the state has a much more limited ability to cope in this situation. So thank you for bringing up that point. So with that, and seeing no further questions, Representative Schultz is going to renew her motion that House File 168, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means.
You know, let's think this through. What's your thoughts on that? Because
Representative Hamilton, are you seeking recognition? Sorry.
Today, and get press on it today.
Representative Hamilton, sorry, I'm hearing you. Maybe you need to be muted or. Okay. Anyway, so we're going to vote. I think on this, I think we can do a voice vote. Unless there's. You know what? Maybe because I won't be able to hear if there's a majority on this vote, maybe we should do a roll call on this one. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, can you call the roll?
Hi, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Liebling.
Aye.
Schumacher.
Aye.
Bacon.
Aye.
Baker.
Aye.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
Aye.
Branson.
Aye.
Gruenhagen.
No.
Haley.
Huh.
Aye.
Halverson.
Aye.
Hamilton. Hamilton. Jordan.
Aye. Jordan, aye.
Keel.
Aye.
Kunish Padin.
Aye.
Mann. Moran.
Aye.
Munson.
No.
Noor.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Schultz.
Aye.
Now I'm going to go back to Hamilton. Okay.
There being 16 ayes and 2 nays, the bill is passed. The motion prevails. and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. And thank you very much, Representative Lippert and Representative Schultz, for all your hard work on this really important issue. Really appreciate that. So next, we're going to move on then to Representative Halverson. And this one, members, is an informational hearing because the committee does not have possession of the bill. So it is our intention to learn about this bill, and then we will revisit this in another hearing where we will just bring it up and vote on it. But this is our opportunity to learn about this issue and ask questions on the bill. So Representative Halverson, welcome. Do you want to start and introduce the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing this bill. This bill came up as an idea very early as we started talking about COVID relief for Minnesotans and thinking about how we can get resources into people's hands as quickly as possible to stabilize families. And so this would give an additional $500 one-time increase to MFIP families. Some of the most vitally important and vulnerable people that we have in our public programs. MFIP is a program that is temporary. It is tied to seeking work and education. And folks that are on MFIP tend to be on it for about half as long as they're able to be on average. And the department can certainly check my numbers, but that's the last time that I looked. And so it's, I think it's important that we do everything we can to provide stability for these families and make sure that we're providing resources for some of the most vulnerable people. From an economic perspective, it is these are dollars that are going to go right back into the economy in numerous ways very, very quickly as families work to keep themselves housed, keep them their families fed, purchase resources for schools, for their education of their kids, etc. So it's going to happen really, really quickly. The money would come from the TANF fund. According to what I've learned from the department, at the end of 2023, the projected balance of TANF would be almost $29 million. The cost of this one-time bump to MFIP families would leave a balance in the MFIP fund of in excess of $15 million. So the fund would still be quite healthy. In addition, the original bill proposal had a significant general fund appropriation so that the state could help the counties implement this. Since then, the department has said that they can do this work in-house. And so I have an amendment to reduce the general fund appropriation, and we would get a state match with that general fund appropriation, which would bring the state's responsibility from the general fund down significantly to about $92,000. So that's a brief introduction of the bill, and look forward to hearing from others. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. So next, we have testifiers. We have Nikki Farrago from the Department of Human Services. Ms. Farrago, are you on?
Yes, Representative Liebling, Chair Liebling, I'm here.
Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you to Representative Halverson for bringing the bill forward today. As Representative Halverson said, this is a one-time payment for families who would be receiving MFIP at the time that the payment is dispersed. So depending on timing, we would be planning to get this out in June or July to help those that are experiencing hardships, additional hardships due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Right now, we have just under 27,000 families that are currently receiving MFIP in the state of Minnesota. The vast majority of parents who are enrolled on MFIP have either just lost a job or left a job, concentrated in a few markets. So that's hotel and restaurant, which we know are being impacted significantly during this time, retail as well, and temporary agencies and low-wage healthcare occupations. So all of those are areas that we see people coming out of those jobs when they go on to MFIP. This is true now, but it was also true before we saw the pandemic. And these are people who are limited in their options following the loss of a job. They don't have access to unemployment insurance, so they go on to MFIP. We also see the impacts of these being felt most often by women who are in these positions, who are often women of color in these lower wage jobs. And I also want to point out, I always find this to be a really important fact, is that about 70% of all our MFIP recipients are children. So when we talk about an increase to MFIP of any kind, we're talking about helping children, our most vulnerable children in the state of Minnesota. Our families on MFIP have an average of 2 children in their family. So with that, I will pass it back off to the chair or any other testifiers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Farrago. Appreciate it. Next, we have Jessica Webster. And just to let members know, I do have some members with questions, but we'll let Jessica Webster testify, and then we'll go to questions. So I have Baker, Kunish, Padin, and Munson. So Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in this virtual world. I am speaking on behalf of Legal Aid, and we're in support of this one-time payment, but we're also joining about 55 statewide organizations and coalitions that are in support of this payment. Minnesota would follow West Virginia and New Jersey in making this payment to vulnerable families accessing TANF, or as we call it, the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Ms. Farrago covered a lot of what I was going to cover on the Minnesota Family Investment Program, and I think a lot of you are really comfortable with what this program is and who it serves. So I just wanted to talk about some of the questions and comments that I've received from legislators to maybe talk about some of the myths and some of the things that we're hearing. And one of the things I've been hearing in the past several weeks are that these parents haven't lost anything like workers. They haven't lost income. Their income didn't go down. And it's not really true, because what Ms. Farrago said is that these parents are workers. Most parents have recently lost a job. The unlucky thing is that they lost this job maybe in December, January, maybe this fall, and they lost it from hotel, restaurant, retail, temp work, but they're not going to be eligible for unemployment insurance. And so a minimum wage worker who lost restaurant work last month will get about $800 in unemployment insurance and traditional unemployment insurance for the month. And they're also eligible for this really generous $600 booster you've heard about. So a minimum wage restaurant worker that lost work after the pandemic hit is receiving about $3,200 a month in unemployment insurance and stimulus relief, which is not something that families accessing MFIP are gonna be able to access. Another thing we've heard is that, well, these families are gonna get stimulus checks. And that's another thing, that many families haven't seen stimulus money yet, and it may be later this summer before they do see it, if they see it. Those families had to have bank accounts, had to have direct deposit listed with, they had to have filed taxes to be able to get those checks swiftly deposited into accounts. Some families don't have bank accounts. Some have changed bank accounts in the last 1 to 2 years if they actually did file taxes and were eligible for refunds. So that stimulus check is not a guarantee for a lot of families right now, and they haven't seen it. Another more common one we're hearing is, but there's an eviction moratorium right now. What is it you keep telling me? They need it for rent, but there's, what do they need it for? Because nobody's being evicted. And I think that there seems to be some confusion about what an eviction moratorium is. This is not a rent holiday. This is not rent forgiveness. A lot of families paid the rent on April 1, and rent is also going to be due on May 1 and June 1. That's $700 to $1,200 a month that families are paying. And the average MFIP cash assistance for people who are working is about $300 a month. And for people who have lost work, it's about $632 a month for a family of three. So there's still a gap in making rent. And even though we know some employers are hiring night right now, some people are bringing people back, it's not a slam dunk to be able to access work and access hours right now. And so there is a gap on making rent, and rent is still due for all of these families. One other question we got is, why don't they access county emergency assistance? Don't we have an emergency assistance program for families? Some counties are denying emergency assistance to families right now because of the eviction moratorium. So we're seeing policies in Anoka and Washington County that just won't issue emergency assistance for rent right now because they say nobody is at risk of losing their housing in the next 30 days. We've been in hearings and representing families on that issue because once again, the rent is due. This rent hasn't been forgiven. Families are now building up rent and they're at higher risk of eviction. I think we're gonna have a pretty serious housing crisis come May and June when families have these chunk payments of rent that they weren't able to make. And that's also stressful for landlords that haven't been paid. It's hard on small businesses that manage properties. And then the last comment that's been made to me is, you know, why don't families or parents just go to work? There's jobs right now. And, you know, one of my complaints about the way the federal unemployment insurance relief was structured is that for workers who had significant hour reductions, but not quite deep enough to access unemployment insurance, those workers don't access unemployment insurance or pandemic $600 unemployment insurance. So if you were a minimum wage worker, which most parents accessing the Minnesota Family Investment Program are, and you were making $10 an hour for 40 hours a week, if you were cut to 25 hours, you're not going to be eligible for unemployment and you're not going to be eligible for pandemic unemployment. So it feels like a real injustice to employers that try to do the right thing, keep people on the rolls. Maybe some of those employers will be able to get the PPP access. Many won't. So there is this gap in access to all of these relief programs that are being talked about. And there's not this largesse sitting out there that families are that's raining down on families because it's just not happening. So in closing, I thought that this one-time payment from federal TANF funds would be a relatively easy thing to get done. And it does feel like it's stalled, even though we've seen bipartisan support in the House and the Senate for it. I hope that can be overcome and that we can just hit send on these federal funds. $500 is not a huge amount of money, but it is a meaningful amount of money. It's about 2 weeks of lost unemployment insurance for families who are out of work. And I think as we're looking at who is being left behind by stimulus, by unemployment, this is a population of families and children that is definitely being left behind.
Okay. So thank you, Ms. Webster. And so members, we are quite close to the end of our hearing now, and we can go until 12:35, but then we must end. So we have three members with questions. We have Baker, Kunish, Padin, and Munson. So very, very brief, please. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is a question for Ms. Webster again. I think your approach is proper when we also didn't see this major stimulus with federal money coming out. What I heard today was 27,000 families are right now on this program. Of that, I am going to guess a large part of that is folks that just recently got unemployment, have been on the system for a while, so they're plugged into the federal government. They likely, a large part of these families likely received the stimulus check. If they have average of two children, again, that's $1,200 per adult plus $500 per child. That is a one-time payment that I also support, and I'm glad that they got that. What I want to be really careful of is I'm hearing a lot of comments like some of these were unemployed beforehand. Some of them didn't get cut enough of this. I think our biggest challenge that we face right now, and not a single one of us wants to be here, we have to make sure people are not getting double payments, if you will, or getting more than they should be getting when we don't know the exact number. So if you want to get it to people, this $500 one-time money, I can support it if I know that they didn't get the stimulus money and if they're not getting unemployment insurance with the $600 a week kicker. We just have to make sure that we find a scalpel that's sharp enough to identify those people that need that help. I can support that. But to just do kind of the whole group of 27,000 families, I say a lot of those folks have been getting help, and I just want to hear your comments on that because we have to ask ourselves those really hard questions.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we don't really have time for a comment, but what I see that Representative Halverson, who's the author of the bill, is taking notes, and making note of that. This bill is not, you know, we can continue to work on the bill. So I think that's a good comment for her to take under consideration. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, and I apologize. Mine is not a question, but it is a statement of support. As a single mom 25 years ago and recipient of MFIP, $500 can make a big difference in the everyday life of a family. When you are living penny to penny, the uncertainty of the situation right now only adds to the stress of a family. Many of our families are struggling to do the distance learning and meet the needs of their children. I can only imagine that this additional assistance, it's not a handout, it's an investment in our families, it's an investment in our futures. And I can only imagine that it will provide a moment of relief, perhaps. And because a person is sitting on or living on an assistance from our state and from our county does not make them ineligible for this kind of an assistance at this time. And I would certainly appreciate all of you supporting this vote.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. And just a reminder, we're not going to vote on the bill today. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to really echo what Representative Baker had said. There's so many programs and so many different monies that are coming available to people with the stimulus check. And we're also hearing about $100 million housing subsidy to help pay rent for people who are going through difficult times that I too am concerned about multiple payments going to people. If people had jobs just recently and were unemployed and are on assistance now, they filed taxes last stimulus. So I think there should be multiple disqualifiers for this payment if it goes through, based on if they're receiving money from the housing through or stimulus check or unemployment or other monies that are available. So. Those are my concerns, and I guess I'll, since we don't have time for comments, I won't ask a question, but thank you for time, Madam.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Representative Halverson, do you want to take the last word here? And we need to be off in 3 minutes, but I want to give you the opportunity to close up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to everybody who testified and spoke up for this bill. I think it's important to note that anybody who's getting UI benefits, it would make people not eligible for MFIT. So we really are talking about a population that is in need and is not being caught up by the many other programs. And at the same time, when we're talking about the number of children that we're talking about, with 70% of the recipients being children, the vulnerabilities are real. And the fact that rent is going to be stacking up and bills are going to be stacking up, that these folks don't have other resources for, really speaks to the urgent need that we need to take this on. And we can do it because we do have federal TANF dollars available, and that fund is currently healthy. And so we can really make a difference in people's lives in the short term and really provide some stability for some of the most vulnerable families. So appreciate people's support for these families and the children of Minnesota. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Thank you, everyone. Just as a reminder, we don't have this bill in front of us today. We will be bringing it up at a future hearing just to vote on. So just to make everyone aware of that. So thank you all very much for your participation today, and we are adjourned.